You're listening to The Spear, a podcast about the combat experience from the Modern War Institute at West Point.
More than 100 meters outside the village, you were definitely getting in a firefight.
My first patrol I took, we had a far ambush.
And then it was just a huge explosion.
The primary threat was RKG-3 grenades.
Light machine guns and AK-47s, that kind of thing.
Small arms fire, RPG fire.
Explosively formed penetrators.
Suicide bombs.
And then that's about the time that the third IED went off.
And that's when another grenade comes spinning over the side of the wall.
And it's at that point the IED chain detonates.
There was enemy in the wire.
There's all these Humvees on fire.
It was truly bullets flying from every angle that you could see.
I open the door and look outside, and all I see is muzzle flashes.
There's a guy on top with a 240, and the rounds pass right past his head.
At that point, our instincts kicked in.
One pilot on the controls, the other pilot was using his M4 to engage single-man targets on the ground.
You're shooting at everything.
It was a fight.
Welcome back to another episode of The Spear. My guest on this episode is Major Joe Ritter. Joe, thanks so much for joining me.
Happy to be here.
So you are an Air Force major. We've had a number of Air Force officers as we've kind of sought to kind of expand the bounds of the combat experiences that we feature. But yours is particularly unique in that you are an MQ-9 pilot. Can you first kind of give listeners maybe a little bit of a sense of your background, what brought you into the Air Force, and how you ended up flying the MQ-9.
Sure. I actually started out as an Air Force intelligence officer, and right out of my initial training for that, I got the opportunity to fill an air crew position, and I was on the RC-135 reconnaissance aircraft, and I enjoyed flying, and there's a joke to be made that the air part of the Air Force is the most fun thing we get to do, and I liked the flying aspect of it. At that time, we were deploying a lot to OEF then, and there was a tactical ISR aspect to the mission that we did that I found really satisfying. And I liked being kind of straddling that line between the two and the three side, or the ops and the intel side. And I got an opportunity to have a follow-on flying assignment. And from there, I just felt like I'd flown to the point and I really enjoyed it. And I wasn't really relishing the idea of going to a headquarters analysis type intel assignment. And at that time, the Air Force was fairly desperate for manpower, especially more senior guys to come over to the MQ-9 force. So I responded to an email and said, yes, I will volunteer. And a few months later, I found myself learning how to fly the MQ-9.
And is that a typical transition to make from intelligence or from some other field to flying this aircraft?
It is not. Just anecdotally from the guys that I know, there's a lot of converted navigators, just as the Air Force inventory of aircraft with navigators gets smaller. But outside of that, most of our manpower are new accessions. So I'm definitely one of the old guys in the community. We are very heavy on newly trained lieutenants that are flying with us. And there's a handful of folks who have come over from other platforms, conventional or traditional pilots. But I would say I am a rarity. I think I know a couple converted engineers and a couple converted maintenance guys who are also doing it, but I'm one of the few intel.
And you know, one of the interesting things is that we've got unmanned aircraft doing some of the same missions that traditionally have been done by manned aircraft. How different is the training pipeline, say, to fly the MQ-9 as opposed to a manned aircraft?
It's probably the biggest difference. It's shorter. And that for sure. And probably the biggest difference is that it's less of a building block approach, whereas in the kind of a conventional guy who goes on to fly, you know, F-16, F-15, you'll start out in a primary trainer and then go to secondary trainer before you go to your main aircraft. Whereas we had a very short initial flight training in a general aviation type aircraft, and then a little bit of FAM in a primary trainer, but you jump into a first a simulator that was kind of a hybrid MQ-1, MQ-9 tabletop simulator, and then actually flying the MQ-9 very early. And our training is very front-loaded tactically, whereas a lot of the stuff that other aircraft would focus on kind of the basic airmanship, just because of the nature of the airplane, the automation takes care of a lot of that for you. We get to introduce tactics fairly early in the training pipeline. So that's a big difference.
So the MQ-9 is, I guess, more colloquially known as the Reaper. Can you kind of describe the aircraft and its capabilities?
Sure. So the big thing, we're kind of a medium altitude hybrid ISR and strike aircraft. That actually, I think we'll probably get into it a little bit later, but one of the challenges organizationally is we're not always great at figuring out on that hybrid side the best ways to use us. Some communities, Air Force Special Operations has kind of figured out sensor shooter, and I think Army Aviation with your CCA guys have figured out kind of sensor shooter tactics. The Air Force, because we've had traditional ISR platforms that collected, and then we've had traditional, you know, strike and shoot and strike assets that didn't really have any kind of an intel capability, and learning to put those together has been a challenge. But the airplane itself is roughly the size of an A-10, obviously somewhat different shape, quite a bit lighter. It's got it's fairly slow. That's probably one of our biggest downfalls. Most people, I'm sure, have seen it, but one of the biggest things that I like to point out is, despite the remote nature of it, and some people will call it a drone, the Air Force doesn't like the D word, but it's probably more operator or more pilot intensive than many aircraft, just because of the available automation that's there. So much of that is just to make the thing work, that a lot of the flying tasks are very much man in the loop.
So you mentioned the D word, drone, which is probably the most typical sort of, again, colloquial name for the type of aircraft. But the Air Force calls them what, remotely piloted aircraft. I think in joint doctrine, we have UAS, unmanned aircraft systems. There are also, you know, I think a bit older of a term, unmanned aerial vehicles. Why do we have so many names for this, you know, this category of platforms?
I know specifically as the Air Force has kind of settled on the RPA, remotely piloted aircraft, what we're really trying to capture is to not define the aircraft simply by the way that it operates. You know, a lot of people, if you're a student of aviation, will talk about how the F-16 is a fly-by-wire aircraft, and it was one of the early fly-by-wire aircraft to use essentially an electrical flight control system. And our flight control system just happens to put the pilot removed from the airplane. But beyond a handful of things in the data link architecture, that really doesn't impact how we fight and how we operate. The airplane can do many, has much, a lot of overlap with manned ISR platforms. In fact, we've had some manned platforms that were fielded in OIF and OEF kind of to fill the gap, because we didn't have enough Predators and Reapers to go around. I know the Army uses a UAS term, and I believe, if you're correct, that's the joint is UAS. And I think it's just a matter of capturing the fact that, yes, there's not a pink body in there, so that's important. You know, if you have a safety issue, like if you lose the engine, the important part is not recovering the pilot. It's making sure that the sensitive items on board are taken care of, or that you don't crash the thing into somebody. From an aviator's perspective, your emergency procedures or your calculus changes, because you're not worried about protecting an aircrew as much as you're worried about not hurting someone on the ground, and then access to the platform if you do have to crash land it. But I think it's really because it is a new capability, and we've been so busy in combat operations in OIF, OEF, OIR, and now OFS and other campaigns in CENTCOM, that we really haven't had the time to sit back and develop, necessarily hammer out a clean way to capture the capabilities across the DoD.
Okay. So, you know, notwithstanding efforts that we've been making, especially lately, to kind of expand the types of combat stories that we feature on the Spear, the bulk of them are ground combat stories. And what that has meant is that for Iraq and Afghanistan, most of them are several years old, at least. You know, it seems like every other episode we feature is from, 2011, 2012 in southwestern Afghanistan, in a few Argandab and Panjway, and a couple of places that keep coming up because that was where the bulk of this action was happening. As these wars have sort of evolved, the ground combat element, at least U.S. involvement in the ground combat element of it, has diminished to a considerable degree. There are other elements of the U.S. war effort that have not, and clearly yours is one of those. So this is quite possibly the newest, most recent story that we're going to feature, because I believe it took place just a couple years ago in October 2018. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So one of the first questions that I often ask people is, where did this take place? And I love when I kind of asked you if you could kind of describe, the five W's for the where section, the location. You've got South Central Afghanistan / Creech Air Force Base, which is clearly something that we have never, I've never come across when I'm recording these, because there are this action took place in two locations. Can you kind of describe, first off, what sort of a day of flying a mission like this is like, how it starts? Do you get up and go to work just like any other day?
Probably the biggest difference is at the time, the unit that I was part of, we did a rotating shift schedule. So I believe this flight was on, I believe it was our swing shift, which is basically a 3 to midnight fly-in period. But yes, it's very, very much kind of normal. Get up, and that is probably the psychology of remote aviation, the fact that you have people that are engaged in combat operations from home station is definitely new. I know the intelligence community and the space community has the same thing, but because we have kind of a kinetic footprint, it is a little different with the MQ-9 and formerly the MQ-1. But yeah, we would get up, get to work at whatever our showtime was, have a mass brief or a formal brief, which is pretty common throughout Air Force aviation when you've got multiple aircraft. And we'd have a schedule so that we'd know, I believe the day before, usually at least who we were flying with, or what GCS or cockpit we were going to fly out of. And sometimes you could infer certain things about the mission, but we were fairly dynamic in the ways. Obviously, the capability is highly requested throughout the AOR. And at that time in Afghanistan, it was, you really didn't know where you were going to go and what you were going to do. We would get a tasking through the Air Force intelligence process, which would tell us where to go. But that often, it was very common to be dynamically retasked. So we would plan for deviations.
And I guess when I was kind of asking about the aircraft's capabilities, I should have asked specifically this as well. How long can it stay in the air?
It depends, weather conditions, payload, but normally our takeoff to land time was in excess of 20 hours. So it's a significant part of the day. So you'll have, probably the biggest difference is you'll have multiple crews of airplanes. I mentioned the rotating shifts. It's a very common, the crew change is kind of a normal part of RPA life that isn't really something that happens, where a new crew will come in and kind of tap you on the shoulder and take over and start flying that mission. So one of the things that we like to do, like if you're supporting somebody that you're talking to on a radio, is you'll tell them like, hey, we're doing a crew swap. You're going to hear a new voice come up and talk to you. That's especially obvious if you have a male pilot and a female pilot swaps out. That's confused a few people at times. So that's something we tend to do. But yeah, you'll have multiple sets of crews that will control the airplane. And as well as we'll have with the launch and recovery concept, what we were doing was we had a forward launch element that actually did the takeoff. And then we would do a satellite handover. And where I was in what we call the mission control element, we would gain control of the airplane, still in the terminal environment, but at altitude, and do kind of our set up the, make sure the SATCOM was configured, run some of our maintenance checks, and then deal with, get our ATC routing to get out to the working area.
So on this day in October 2018, again, when you show up to work at 3, was it a case of, hey, the aircraft's already up, you're going to do, you're going to swap out with the current crew, or was it a mission that you were going to be taking over from the forward element that was going to launch it?
We were actually the, we call the gaining crew, so we were the first ones to touch it. Myself and my sensor operator, his call sign's Fang. He and I had to set up the gaining, which is not unlike, it's essentially where you pre-flight the GCS, the ground control station, go in and make sure that all your switchology is configured. Because it is essentially, you are taking control of an airplane that's in the air. So you want to make sure that the autopilot settings are matched in the emergency things. And so you haven't done something dumb like leave the throttle in the off position. So your engine turns off when you gain the airplane. So we have about a 40 to 45 minute checklist that you go through to get the GCS ready for flight, and then some communication via the between the forward element and us to ensure that we were ready. We'd get a clearance from the tower for where we were going to go, and then climb up to our working altitude, and then transit out to the airspace.
And how long does the actual transition of control of the aircraft take?
When it works properly, 2 to 3 seconds. The screens kind of flicker. There's generally a kind of an ugly burst of static in the headsets as the radio, from the radio, just as it goes, momentarily lost link. But the way we do it is we're able to get the what we call the return link. So we're able to see out the nose camera or the targeting pod and all the telemetry. So you can see what the airplane's doing, and you're seeing the launch and recovery element flying it. So we'd get the video, and we'd see them, you know, doing the climb out, just looking at the Kandahar horizon, as it is, the Afghan sky there, climbing out and monitor, like, yep, engine gauges look good, all the standard aircraft parameters that we'd look at, fuel, oil, electrics, make sure all of those looked good and looked normal. And then when we're ready, essentially, I turn on what they call the command link, and then I get control of it, and then I make sure that I can control the airplane from the pilot's side. The sensor operator goes through some checks to make sure everything that he has is working, and then we start the process of going out to our our tasked working area.
So what was the mission that day?
So what we had been briefed, and this, I'll preface this by saying I'm not at all a spear against any of the intel folks that provide the tasking or the agencies forward that kind of task us. As you know, like with combat operations, things get muddied, and one of the kind of eternal challenges is the air planning cycle doesn't always align well with the planning cycle that ground guys use, especially in the special operations world. So we had, before we walked out to the cockpit for the gaining handover, we'd gotten an intel brief that based on our assignment for the day, we were going to go do target development or pre-soaks for an op area, essentially go out, do FMV of some named areas of interest, look at some potential HLZs, and just do pattern of life type ISR. So that was what we had, that's what we had planned walking out the door, and that was what we expected. The first indication that that wasn't what was going to happen was right after we got the airplane, I was talking to our tactical C2, trying to request the airspace that I wanted, and there was a ROS, or a restricted operating zone, that was kind of right where I wanted to be, and that was surprising. And a little bit weird. And we were, I think it delayed us probably 10 to 15 minutes just because we were trying to figure out what the ROS was, why it was there, and who owned it, who I needed to talk to get permission to fly into that airspace.
What does that mean? Does that mean that there are other aircraft probably operating in that area?
Potentially. It's fundamentally, ROS is a kind of a fire support coordination measure where you just throw up a center point with a radius and an altitude and says nobody flies in here unless you're talking to the JTAC or whoever it is that's controlling that, just to keep the airspace clear so you don't have to worry about deconflicting fires or, in a lot of cases, you're worried about noise abatement and things like that in an op area.
Okay. So how long does it take you from the time you take control to get to, you know, to be on station essentially?
It was not a very long transit this day. It was probably a 30 minute transit, which is Again, probably one of the weird parts of remote aviation. A lot of times, once you get in transit, that's when guys will call in a brake crew just to come in. And you've got it. Essentially, you've got the autopilot flying a whatever your ATC or C2 assigned routing is. And that's when a lot of us will go either check back in with intel, like, hey, he's hearing anything different, or a good time to make a bathroom break or fill up the coffee cup. And I think... on this day, I don't think we did that because it was short enough. Like, we were like, all right, we're just going to stay here and drive in because this is a little bit weird and I want to get into this airspace. And I had a lot of the communication is via internet relay chat, which is probably anybody who spent time downrange is probably familiar with Merck. And so we're using Merck to do a lot of our coordination with some of the with the C2 agencies and with the supported unit. And it was probably 20 minutes into that 30-minute transit when we finally figured out the radio frequency that we needed for that ROS. So I got that frequency and got that plugged into our line of sight radio.
Okay, so for if you can kind of spatially orient listeners, you take off, or the aircraft takes off, you take over, you're flying out to a particular point or a particular area. Is the ROS sort of co-located with that point, or do you have to try to fly through it or around
it? Is. Where is it? Okay. We use kind of a kill box keypad system is one of the primary ways that we navigate, that the Air Force does kind of tactical airspace management, just because it's easy and it works well for most of the things that we're trying to do. So essentially, the area where this takes place was I believe it was just southeast of Tarankaut, for those that are familiar with Afghanistan. So we're essentially going a straight line going there, and our start point where we're going to is basically co-located with this restricted airspace. And I'd got approval, the way a lot of these approvals work is you'll get approval via Merck from someone to, all right, you are notionally approved into the airspace, but contact this controller on this frequency prior to entry. So that was the approval we had. We had a kind of a penciled in altitude block that was going to be clear, but we still needed to ask permission to enter and operate in there from the, in this case, it was the guys on the ground, that we weren't expecting anybody to be on the ground. So again, that was some confusion. And I think most folks who have spent time in OIR or OFS are probably familiar with kind of the challenges of overlapping battle spaces and overlapping operations. So initially we were kind of wondering, is somebody else doing here? And we're working for a different organization and they don't know about it. And we just have to kind of be a non-player, and it was trying to figure out what the actual situation was a bit of a challenge.
And what was the situation?
So probably the funny thing that I remember is as soon as we got the frequency put in the radio, we were able to hear the JTAC on the ground. And I remember he was giving a report that they were in the middle of a tick. And I think I heard something. He said something like, we're troops in contact, heavy machine gun fire, that kind of a report. They did have another ISR asset that was on station that he was kind of relaying that information to. And I remember I looked at Fang and I was like, all right, dude, this is different. But at that point, it's very much, you know, even though we hadn't necessarily briefed to that, we're all trained to close air support and to execute CAS. So kind of everything that I had walked out to the cockpit that day thinking pre-soaks kind of goes out the window, and mentally we're like, all right, CAS playbook, where we're going to, you know, go through the CAS basics, figure out where our friendlies are, figure out where the enemy is, what direction the threats are, and just get a situation on the battle space. So I heard that, kind of waited for a lull in the conversation, called the JTAC, told him who I was. I didn't give him a full CAS check-in just to save time. Kind of told him who I was, that I was an MQ-9. I was coming to him, and I was going to be entering the airspace at whatever altitude we were at that day. And kind of initially, he gave us the task, and I could tell the guy was task saturated just by the way he was talking on the radio, and we were hearing gunfire go off in the background. So I didn't really want to waste any of his time. And initially, I think he gave me the tasking to get visual friendlies and do defensive scans. So we got a friendly location. The sensor operator gets the targeting pod vicinity where the friendlies were, and they were in a rod, remain over day site. We got some visual on where they were kind of hunkered up in their fighting position and started scanning around. And we did that for just looking for threats and just trying to get SA on the battle space. We've got some imagery so we can kind of see what it looks like. But we didn't really have great SA on, you know, the actual battlefield geometry. So we're trying to look around and look for threats while at the same time build our own picture. And probably the biggest limfac of the MQ-9 is you really can't see a lot with any fidelity. So you have to choose between a really zoomed out field of view, which is great for, you know, getting that bird's eye perspective, or you zoom in and you're looking through a soda straw. So we were kind of doing our best to look around, provide those defensive scans, as well as figure out what was going on. Kind of at the same time as this is happening, you know, there's some kind of aviation 101 tasks where we're getting there, like setting up the orbit. At that time, I'm hand flying the airplane. So in MQ-9 terms, hand flying is the autopilot is taking care of the altitude and the airspeed. And I'm basically just controlling the left, right. So I think I had a setup kind of flying a roughly circular type orbit, just trying to figure out what was going on. And I had asked our Intel support, if they could get us a product for this, because I don't believe we had a DRG, a ground reference graphic. So we were trying to get some kind of a product to make sure that we could speak the same language. And we had the terrain reference points and the building numbers that the ground party was going to be fighting off of. And they were trying to get that. And there's basically it gets emailed to the squadron, then it has to get uploaded onto a computer where I can get to it while I'm flying the airplane, while the sensor operator's flying. I get that loaded into some of our situational awareness products. And while that was going on, and kind of my intentions divided between the situation on the ground where these guys are in a little bit of a tick, it wasn't, you know, a close fight. So they'd taken some indirect fire and some heavy machine gun fire. So they were responding to that. But probably within 2 to 3 minutes of us getting there and starting those defensive scans, we hear that they're going to return fire with mortars, and that they are targeting a particular set of buildings where they think they're being fired on from. And at that point was probably kind of a big decision point for us, because we were thinking, well, we can keep scanning around. And it was very open. We didn't see any obvious threats. You know, typically the Taliban is smart enough not to stand out in the open and shoot at Americans, because bad things happen to them when they do. So I told the sensor operator, I was like, hey, let's go see if we can get contact on their splashes and see what's going on.
What does that mean?
So we essentially slew the targeting pod over to see where their mortars are impacting, and look to see, you know, are there people squirting? Are there bad guys running from those impacts? Are they hitting? You know, are they targeting a particular structure? Do we see outgoing fire, or, you know, do we see the Taliban shooting back at our friendly element?
So you almost then take on the role of like a forward observer.
Very, very much. And it's kind of funny. Like, I nowhere in my training in the MQ-9, I mean, I've been trained to do CAS and trained in, had some joint fires training, but nobody taught me how to spot mortar fire. It just so happens I heard it done enough listening to fires nets over the years and through some other deployments. I kind of knew what to do. So we got the sensor over there. We got contact, or meaning we could see those splashes. And right about the same time, our Intel folks were able to get us the GRG. So we had a common reference. So rather than saying the building at this grid, you hit 20 meters north of it, I actually had a point. So I could say, I'm tally impacts, you know, 10 meters east of building 42, or whatever the case was. And, I just kind of decided, like, all right, we're going to try and do our best here to help these guys out, because they've got, they're largely alone and in a fight. So we started calling out some corrections on where they were hitting. And one of the rounds had a pretty significant secondary explosion that went off. So I called that out to the JTAC. He acknowledged that, and we kind of were all in the consensus that where their rounds were impacting was probably a cache site where the enemy had engaged them from. And I think there was kind of a lull in the mortar fire where they stopped to adjust, or I'm not sure, but they stopped firing for a little bit, and almost instantly we started seeing some movement in the target area. We were using the IR camera primarily, and it was very pretty challenging terrain. It was these kind of low walls and compound type clusters, the mud brick or the mud rock type buildings you see a lot in Afghanistan. And there was a lot of brush around. So we were seeing like parts of people as much as we were seeing actual people in the IR picture. You know, you'd see a hotspot that was somebody kind of running around a corner. So we were trying to identify who these people are. You obviously want to make sure, like, are these enemy combatants or these civilians? What's going on here? Is this a threat? So for us, I talked about earlier, it seems like for all the automation that the MQ-9 gives you, in some ways, it's not a pilot-friendly airplane. Because based on what the vegetation was like in the terrain, we were maneuvering pretty aggressively to be able to keep any kind of visual contact on these folks and be able to track them, because from our altitude, people get masked fairly easily. They go behind a wall, go behind a tree, or they just get into thick canopy where even with infrared, you can't necessarily see them. So you're essentially kind of standing the airplane on the wing and doing pretty tight turns, which it's not going to win any maneuverability contests. Generally about 30 degrees of bank is the best that we can get, especially when we're heavy.
And about how high are you flying at this point typically?
I can't remember, but we were probably somewhere between 15 and 20,000 feet above the ground level. So, add a few thousand feet to that would have been our altitude. We'll call that our HAT, height above target.
Yes. So, I find this fascinating because this, you launched as an ISR mission. And, I think most people are familiar with the fact that this particular aircraft can, and, both the Reaper and the Predator can do ISR and they can do kinetic strike. And I've watched quite a few hours of ISR footage from the Reaper, and it's never even really occurred to me that that could be armed and that platform could transition its mission quite quickly. Is there a moment where you sort of shift gears from, okay, we were doing ISR, now we're clearly in a CAS role, or is it just sort of a blurred, we're doing both?
From my perspective, it's very much always we're doing both. We fly with the weapons on pretty much all the time as a just in case, just to have that firepower in case it is needed, because it is dynamic. You never know when a tick or is going to pop off or something significant is going to happen where you need an air-to-ground capability. So I know for me and most of the, and as an instructor pilot, most of the guys that I train, it's when you're actively communicating with a JTAC on the ground, is a fires type guy, you get into that fires mode where he may still have ISR requirements. He needs you to find where the enemy is, where the threats are coming from, but you're thinking more cast wise, and you're thinking more to the ends of, all right, I need to locate the enemy, and if required, I'm going to employ. One of the big differences, I think, is part of that, and most people are probably familiar that we've got a pretty robust Intel component on the back end that deals with the video exploitation and things like that. And those guys, when we get into, are really well set up to do, to create products and to be able to create some cool graphics and to do analysis and things like that. But when we get into a more of a real-time, closer support role, a lot of responsibility switches to the air crew, just because the element of time and the fact that we've got the line of sight communications to take a more active role in seeing what's going on and doing some real baseline assessment of, figuring out, hey, I've got personnel moving between these buildings. and try to identify and just build battle space situational awareness.
Okay. So at this point, then you've gotten on station. There's a tick going on. You initially just kind of try to provide some ad hoc, it sounds like, ISR support. And then ultimately, you're helping with battle damage assessments. You're helping coordinate, you're helping the JTAC adjust fire. Was there a point at which you realized, hey, we're an armed platform. You know, there are targets that we can support by hitting these targets.
So absolutely. There's probably one of the important things, like the Reaper has the reputation as the hunter killer RPA. I think that's what the Air Force likes to call it. And at the time I was in an attack squadron, and that's what we train to, is to employ weapons when required. So that's a normal part of our training. So it's always in the back of your mind. Kind of going backwards a little bit, when we talk about kind of handover operations, one of the things that as a pilot I'll always do is run the checks on the weapons and make sure that the weapon status is good before I start a transit, because I'm depending on the day, that might be the indicator for, hey, we're going to need to get a new tasking or need to potentially look at landing and launching a spare aircraft if required. So it's always forefront in your mind that you've got in that case Hellfires. We've also got some other weapons we can't carry, but that day we had just had a loadout of 4 Hellfires.
In this case, is it a when you did ultimately employ the Hellfires? Was it a situation where you see things happening on the ground and you radio down to the JTAC, or you contact the JTAC and say, hey, this is the target, we're going to hit it? Or is it the JTAC calling up and saying, hey, here are these coordinates, this is what we're seeing, we need you to hit it?
Kind of progression can go a lot of ways, and it can both of those things can happen. On this day, we were tracking these guys, and I don't want to gloss over that we were tracking these assessed enemy personnel because it was pretty busy. And one of the things that I remember from that flight is we're trying to track people, and there's obviously too many people running around down there for us to track individuals. So we're trying to kind of jump back and forth between areas of interest and points. What we assessed were probably either cache sites or defensive fighting positions, just to get a consolidated picture of kind of the enemy disposition and tell the JTAC what was going on. So I remember at one point I'm talking on the radio while at the same time I'm kind of waving at the sensor operator and pointing at him, telling him to go north, go south, go other ways, just so we can jump back and forth and build a picture. And as we'd done that, and that was probably a 20 to 30 minute process, it became pretty clear that there was kind of a hub. There was a particular compound, I believe it was the northernmost building in a cluster of these. And that seemed to be the hub that all the personnel were going in and out of. And we'd counted multiple people entering and then leaving and then entering and leaving. And it was also one of the few two-story structures around. So it was pretty clear to see that they had direct line of sight on the friendly position from that second story. And as we're kind of making this assessment, like, hey, this is clearly kind of a central point in this in the battlefield here. The ground party got some intelligence that said that there was enemy personnel that were moving into that area, and they were going to attempt to recover and consolidate weapons and equipment. And kind of at one point, a lot of the movement seemed like was very consolidated, and we had multiple individuals in the structure. And I remember the Fang made fun of me because I have a reputation of being known to try and speak army when I'm talking to the ground to kind of build some rapport. And because normally I kind of Air Force lingo would be like, if you need to strike this target. And I remember I asked the guy, I said, if you are looking for an air to ground solution here, I recommend this. Because that's a very army phraseology. And we had a particular variant of the Hellfire that we had that was kind of optimized for that type of a building target. And he said, copy that, standby 9 line. So I told him, hey, recommend we shoot this missile, recommend this final attack heading. If So in a way, we were kind of driving it. But based on our knowledge of kind of the ROE at play and what was going on and the fact we had outside intel coming up from the ground force that this was enemy and the situation was only going to get worse, it kind of made sense that air-to-ground fires were the next logical escalation and next logical response. So, but once we'd done that, it didn't, you know, again, everything, nothing is simple in war. And we, the Hellfire, you know, it's a fairly small weapon. So I often describe it as a room killer, not a building killer. So we had this L-shaped compound with this raised two-story structure. And the JTAC had basically said, like, yep, we're going to look to employ on this. But obviously, once the enemy personnel were internal, we're kind of just guessing on what to shoot at. And he gave us a nine line, and so the standard cast nine line to employ the Hellfire on this target. Did the readbacks, and we just happened to be in a position where I'd been holding very close just to get a good near vertical look down into the area to try and categorize what was going on. And we had to drive out and build some distance to take a Hellfire shot. And I remember we're like in the turn to coming back around, and you know, I'm thinking very military 101. Well, I know I've got this target. The ground force commander wants it destroyed. It meets all the, it makes sense that we're going to need to engage it. And I just thought, well, for lack of knowing anything better, we might as well shoot the two-story part because that's the one that's got the direct line of sight. So if that's a DFP, if they're using this as a DFP, that's the most likely threat. And I was, it was also the MQ-9, because of our altitude, it's pretty clear that the enemy couldn't hear us or see us. So they probably were acting with a little bit of impunity, thinking there was no air support here.
I was going to ask about that. Is it, I mean, how, you know, how aware, if you're on the ground, how aware, you know, I've been under Reapers that, you know, you clearly, you can see them. Sometimes you can even hear them depending on their height, but I'm sure I've also been under them when I had no idea they were there. Typically in an engagement like this, are you at an elevation that the enemy is unlikely to be aware of your presence?
We always try to be. Sometimes between weather and terrain, you can't be. If you've got a cloud deck that you've got to get under, then you have to think about visual signature reduction. And then audible is a big concern. And I know the Air Force has done some studies into it. Personally, will say I'm not smart enough to be able to tell you all the factors that go into whether or not you can hear us or not. I know I've been under Reapers on the out on the Nellis Range and not been able to hear them. And I've also been under them at higher altitude and heard them very plainly. So,
okay.
But kind of that, and also there's, you have to think about kind of the situation on the ground. Like these Taliban guys, if they're in a tick and they're shooting back at the Americans, you know, they're probably not wearing ear pro, so they're probably not listening too closely. So we can take a little bit more of a risk with the audible. And then we were just high enough. You'd have to be really looking to see us. And again, at that time they were not. And I could kind of, just by the way they were moving around, they weren't necessarily running from us. So I was fairly sure that they hadn't seen us. Which tactically in one way is good for us, but in another sense kind of emboldens them. And there's definitely a part of me that when I'm looking at the tactical problem here, I'm thinking, all right, if we engage this building, we're probably not going to get effects on all the personnel that are inside, but we'll get some of them. We can reduce the most dangerous firing point or the most, you know, the position of advantage. And we'll also send a message like, hey, there's an air asset up here and that's going to have some impact and we can probably break this tick. So we're kind of in our final turn to release the missile, and I'm talking to the sensor, and we have a list of checks that we go through before we employ. And one of the obvious ones is aim point, where, because the sensor operator controls the laser designator, so the pilot has the trigger and fires the missile, but he's the one guiding it in. So I took, you know, a brief second just to look at it, and it's like, all right, I'm not going to try and get too fancy here. We're going to shoot the elevated position. And our weaponeering profile is such that the missile's largely coming straight down. So there's some reasons to do that. And I remember I asked him the question, I said, hey, put it on the raised two-story, any disagreement? And kind of as a question, because if he had seen something different I, you know, wanted him to speak up, and he said, "Nope, I agree." And as we were setting up for that shot, I had reached out to the Intel folks just to confirm, you know, that they had tracked. We had multiple personnel in that building that were from this enemy group that we'd been responding to, and they confirmed that, you know, in the 2 minutes probably before we actually employed the weapon. So we kind of not arbitrarily, but we picked our aim point based on our best guess and some really, you know, kind of military 101, like we'll shoot the high point and see what happens. So we turned in, got a clearance for that strike, fired a Hellfire, hit that target, pretty catastrophic destruction on what we were hitting. Again, these aren't armored buildings or anything. They're largely, you know, mud structures. So we had, we're in the 2 to 3 seconds after impact, we're feeling like we had pretty good effects on that shot. And as the IR bloom is fading away and we're getting good fidelity through the pod back on the target area, we saw, looked like two individuals, we call them squirters, kind of egress from the strike site. And I've gone back and reviewed that video multiple times. And in my opinion, I'm not entirely sure how anybody who was in the targeted structure would have survived, but there's potentially some underground facilities, or if they'd had some tunnels or something, that we said these two guys squirt out. So we kind of go from we were in track mode where we were aggressively following folks to a kinetic engagement that took all of maybe 2 minutes to set up for, took the shot, and then immediately we're back into tracking these guys who ran from the strike site while we're trying to get a kind of a BDA assessment as well.
Okay. And then what comes next? I guess you said you kind of transitioned from kinetic strike back to essentially ISR, albeit ISR in a very active, over a very active, you know, piece of land. Do you are you anticipating having to fire again? Are you, you know, just waiting to hear from the JTAC what they need?
It's a little bit of both. I mean, as air crew, you always, and anytime you do an attack, you want to have a re-attack plan. And what we had briefed up as part of that nine line, that we were going to do an immediate re-attack on squirters. So if we had any enemy that we could PID that egress the target area, we were going to engage those folks. And as in that case, these guys got into a tree line so quickly that we really didn't have an opportunity to maneuver in for a shot and to take a high percentage shot. And the ground force continued to get some intel through their capabilities they had down there that there was enemy, and they also knew they were exfilling a period of darkness that day. So they were obviously concerned about how many enemy are around us, when we're going to have helicopters come in and pick us up. So they wanted to engage any other enemy that we could find. And that's a place where I think maybe the remote aspect helps us out in the MQ-9, because you can sit back at ground speed zero and just kind of look and think, like, I've only got four weapons, now three left. And do I want to take a low percentage shot at people running through a tree line where I may or may not get effects? Or do I want to let the situation develop and figure out what's going on and preserve and use my ISR while I'm preserving my munitions? And that's what we did. Unfortunately, I don't have the video anymore to go back and look, but I believe it was probably about 3.5 to 4 hours of actively tracking guys. And there was a couple situations where we briefed up and we kind of set up for a shot and armed up the system. And then every time before we could get the clearance and release a weapon, either they would move or something dynamic would happen, just to the point that we didn't feel good that it was going to be a high percentage shot. And that that initial Hellfire strike had broken the tick. There was no more fire. There was indications and warnings that these guys were going to do something hostile. So it's very much kind of a waiting game. And I think what happened in this case is we were able to kind of outwait the enemy. Because we kept seeing them kind of move around in small groups and, you know, this kind of tactical movement where guys will kind of bound around corners and things like that. And as we're watching these guys, you know, we've seen some weapons on some without weapons. And, you know, I kind of I'm actively communicating that to the JTAC that, you know, I've got one guy with an AK entered this tree line. And now there's three others that I can't break out anything on them, but they just ran in right behind him. And now they're going to, you know, maneuver through the green zone or through the tree line. And now they're going to dart into a building. And we were tracking them for several hours, just trying to provide real-time updates to give the JTAC and the ground force commander a picture of what's going on. And one of the cool things is that we do have a SATCOM capability. So it was cool that while we're doing that, I can hear the ground force commander on the SATCOM relaying what we're telling him back to his higher headquarters. That was cool because it gives some SA where, and he would provide kind of a standard sitrep thing, his assessment. And I think at one point, like we assessed the BDA from the first shot, we could confirm one enemy killed in action and couldn't confirm any more just because of the rubble. And I'd heard him say something like, we're continuing to develop the situation and I'll provide a report at whatever time. So it was nice that without having to have a lot of communication between, hey, what's the ground force commander's intent here? What do you think? Is we're just listening to him provide his report. So I know exactly what he's thinking as we're developing the situation.
Yeah. And so did you end up firing a second time?
We did. So what kind of happened, and I said, I really think there's probably a joke to be made about, you know, don't be impatient. We talked about the endurance of the MQ-9, and we're unique in that sense. And probably about 3.5 to 4 hours after that initial engagement, we had a group of these adult male enemy personnel kind of come out of a tree line, almost fairly casually, and kind of walk into a small open area and kind of sat down. And at the time, I was so focused on just relaying what I was seeing and deconflicting and looking for collateral concerns or any sort of civilian pattern of life in the area. I didn't really guess what was going on, but having gone back and looked at the video and having seen kind of some some YouTube clips of Taliban guys in action and seeing how they fight, I really think what they were probably doing was kind of having a little meeting, and it looked like they were actually drawing in the dirt, like they were probably, you know, drawing up their sand table of what they were going to do next. And we had this group of, I think it was five individuals out of some vegetation in a clear area with, again, in this area where there'd been no kind of civilian pattern of life. There were some weapons involved on these guys as well. So we kind of told the JTAC immediately what we had. And as soon as told them that they were in a static position in the open, I think he immediately gave us a nine line to engage that target. So we kind of, again, go through the drill of, all right, now we're no longer in a ISR mode. We're looking to prosecute this. So it's a matter of kind of optimizing the airplane in terms of positioning for where we want to be, and then optimizing the sensor to get the best target, the best picture quality for a laser guided weapon shot. Picked out kind of the group of where these guys were and picked out an aim point where we thought we'd get the best effects with a single Hellfire. And employed that weapon, and we got good effects. I think it was five. There was five that we could see, and there was five pretty obvious EKA from that strike. And that really kind of, I don't want to be too, you know, too full of myself and say that that kind of ended the engagement. But after that shot, there was really very little ICOM chatter that the ground reported or any other kind of threat indications. And we didn't see really any movement. We kind of, you know, we joked that everybody who was left alive got smart and just kind of egressed the area. And we had probably another 2 hours in the seat flying, and we just sanitized the HLZs waiting for the helicopters to come in and pick up the ground party. They did that without incident. And I think as they were checking out was when our next crew came to swap us out. And that was essentially the end of the workday. Then we went through and, you know, pulled the tapes, did kind of the AAR process of what happened and made sure that everything looked procedurally correct. There were no glaring errors, and kind of debriefed the engagements.
Well, I've been, you know, kind of jotting things down as you've been telling the story, because I've got a million questions. I'm a little bit cognizant of the time, but I'd like to get through through some of them, because I just think there's so much that we can still unpack. So there are clear rules of engagement. PID, positive identification of a combatant, is vital. When you're in the air and you're flying from that high, obviously, you know, you do, as you said, you can zoom in and you can see things. Before a strike, is the PID the responsibility solely of you, or are you also relying on the ground element to say, hey, these guys just shot at us and we just watched them run into this building or something?
It's really situation dependent. Different operations have different ROE components. One thing I do want to highlight is that our intelligence component that the Air Force that we fly with, because we have what we call PED, processing, exploitation, dissemination, largely imagery analysts that are watching our video every mission. While those guys, just kind of some of the technical challenges, the ways that we can utilize them in a CAS scenario is limited. They can be really helpful, just trying to confirm certain things. There's some kind of indicators, and I mean, I'm sure you've seen it. Just if you look at somebody, you know, from a distance with binoculars, just the naked eye, you kind of have that, I think he's got a weapon, but I'm not entirely sure. And having somebody on the back end that can go back, pause that video, kind of look at it again and review it while we're continuing to track is very helpful. But it's really a hybrid. In that instance, probably the number one thing that led me to believe that we were going to go from a observe the situation, observe and assess, to take that first Hellfire shot was that JTAC called me up to tell me that they had intel based on their capability on the ground, that we were looking at enemy personnel and that they were moving to that area and they were attempting to consolidate men, weapons, and equipment. And that meshed with what we were seeing, because I kind of spoke to, like, it was kind of there was a central hub of where these guys were running out to. So we were, I'm going to say, all right, that's the intel that he's got. That's what I see. You know, I've confirmed we've got some armed personnel in this area. We've got no civilian pattern of life. So ultimately in that situation, it's up to the ground force commander, but there's a lot of responsibility on the air crew, because they are largely, I mean, the GFC is going to trust what you tell them, because we do have the highly capable sensor. So if I say, like, I'm looking at 4 adult males with a weapon system, he's probably going to trust me, even if he can't necessarily see them based on his position or line of sight.
Sure. And speaking of trust, that's a great segue into the next question that I wanted to ask. You know, there have been a number of times when I've talked to Army aviators, helicopter pilots, who have said it's especially useful when they are co-located in Afghanistan or in Iraq with the ground forces that they're supported, because they actually know each other. And so they establish sort of a rapport beforehand. And so it just becomes that coordination just becomes a little bit easier. And there is that established element of trust. That's obviously less likely to be the case with fixed wing aircraft that might be coming from out of area somewhere else in country. But it's obviously never the case with an RPA operator. How cognizant of that are you? And, you know, you did kind of mention some things that you did to try to establish rapport with the JTAC as soon as you got on station. How important is that to try to do so that there is that element of trust?
I think it's hugely important. And just to kind of correct one thing, we actually make a lot of effort to, when we can, build rapport with those guys. We're able to, I mean, depending on the FOBs they're at, we'll do VTCs and things like that. So a lot of times, especially certain mission sets where there's a limited number, the fires team is pretty small. Like, you will, especially I'm lucky to be in a leadership role where I am at a lot of those meetings where I'll know those guys. And I've had the opportunity to take a shot where I, you know, we're using tactical call signs, but I know exactly who the guy is on the other end, and he knows it's me because we've had been on the phone or we've been on VTCs a lot. So that does, it's obviously, you know, virtual like everything else is in 2020, but that yeah. kind of really, those relationships are there, but in this case, it wasn't. I personally, something I teach my student pilots is to, one of the reasons I listen to your podcast is to learn a lot about the supported unit and to be smart enough to have some credibility when they ask you for things. Language is big, and then just sound tactics. Like I knew based on the call sign that the JTAC had that it was an Army controller, not a Air Force guy. So I kind of knew that already. And there's just different, some different kind of radio procedures and kind of your CAS cadence is going to be a little bit different. So I think a really important part is to be smart and sound like you know what you're talking about, while at the same time making sure you're not speeding. So one of the things I train folks to say is you could say like, hey, I'm looking at, you know, four individuals in a spaced out line moving at random intervals through this village, which is a lot to unpack. But when I call up the JTAC and say, hey, I'm Tally, four adult males moving tactically through the target area. Like that means something and they know exactly what I'm talking about. Or, you know, when I can say that there's a, you know, position of advantage or, you know, kind of using that terminology that is familiar. But really it comes down to just being competent and confident as well. It is, you know, from just in the remote aviation community, because we are so new, a lot of Army guys specifically, they know a little bit about us and they know certain things, but they're not as well versed in our capabilities as they might be with, you know, an A-10 or another type of platform. So they're kind of relying on us to do the best that we can and tell them what we can and can't do. So it's just a matter of being a professional and kind of having your ducks in a row that when you get into that situation that you can do things quickly and efficiently and they're not waiting on you or you're not just, you know, sounding like you don't know what's going on or that you're asking them, you know, silly stuff like having them repeat radio calls or things like that. You just want to be, you know, clearly on the spot and quick thinking.
Interesting. So then the next question I want to ask you is you were flying for a number of hours. It sounds like 6, 7, 8 hours or more.
I think it was a 7-hour sortie that day.
Okay. And so 7 hours, the majority of which time is very active. You're doing a lot of stuff. How do you feel at the end of that? When you tap out and the new crew comes in, are you exhausted?
It is. I've had, I've never had the opportunity to be in a kind of a ground combat situation, but I've had a lot of kinetic engagements in the MQ-9 and there is definitely not that. There was another event I had in my career where we employed, it was 5 weapons in 6 hours that I remember. And I remember, I was focused on all the things I needed to do debrief wise and everything at work. And I remember I got home and I just kind of sat on my couch in my flight suit and just kind of stared at the wall and had, you know, a very kind of epic sigh, like that was a lot, just trying to just relax after all that. But especially in a close air support situation, I take a lot of pride in knowing that if I screw up, somebody could die. And if I don't, engage the enemy, somebody could die. Obviously you don't want to have a CIVCAS either. So you want to be judicious with your fires, but you want to be aggressive and lethal in protecting friendly forces. So it is, mentally, it is stressful. Exposure, I think, helps. I've had a lot of strikes and been part of a lot of situations. So, you know, the amount of time it takes to kind of recover from that, I think it gets easier. But it's definitely a emotionally significant event.
So, you know, I want, as a follow-up to that, you know, you mentioned going back and sitting on your couch in your flight suit. Most of the people we talk to, in fact, all of them prior to this have been in country. And so they sort of return to base And I always ask the question, you know, if they went through a particularly trying combat experience, you know, how important is it to sort of process it, you know, that day, that night, over the subsequent, you know, several days versus, you know, do you kind of just put it away and you decide you're going to deal with it when the deployment is over? And, you know, we have this, there's also a transition period for the most part for most units. You know, you'll spend a few days or more in Kuwait or in Qatar on your way back from Iraq or Afghanistan. You know, the Brits send most of their people to Cyprus for, you know, a period of time as this sort of transition, because we recognize the fundamental difference in the sort of day-to-day lived experience in a combat zone versus at home, being in the field versus returning to a garrison training environment and, you know, dealing with family and friends and things like that. Is it difficult to make that transition out of the cockpit, so to speak, and, you know, into your living room?
It can be weird. I personally, it's never been, I'll say it's definitely been weird for me. I won't say I've ever found it particularly difficult. There have been times, especially, cause keep in mind, most RPA squadrons are doing combat operations 24/7, and most of them have kind of a split between the combat operations side and an administrative or combat support side. So there have definitely, I know in my own career, I've had to apologize a couple times for, snapping at, admin folks, because I'd just come out of flying and I'd been either doing something that was stressful in a combat mission, and I'd walked around the side of the base and somebody is asking me for, some paperwork or something. And you have to kind of deprogram yourself, like, hey, we're not fighting anymore. Like, calm down a little bit. But it is, the mission we just talked about, I actually had some friends that were coming into town. I think that was my Friday. And the next day, and I do distinctly remember, like, the next day I was, down on the strip in Vegas, out at a restaurant. And I kind of remember just thinking to myself, like, that's a very long way from, what I was doing 24 hours ago. But it is weird. People complain, Creech Air Force Base is kind of unique in the fact it's kind of out in the middle of nowhere. So I think it's probably good that everybody has about a 45 minute to an hour drive between work and home, just to kind of get yourself, kind of center yourself. I always found that somewhat helpful. It would be weird to, but at other places, I've flown RPAs at other bases where we didn't have that, where I lived 10 minutes away from where I was flying. And I think each individual kind of develops some kind of a ritual. Most of the squadrons, when you go into the secure area, there'll be some kind of a sign that says, like, you're now entering combat operations or something. You're now in a active combat operations floor or something like that. For me personally, I think it's always been kind of at the GCS door. Like, when I close that door behind me, I may still be in wherever I am, but I feel very much like I'm in Afghanistan or Iraq. Like, and it probably helps having had deployment experience to those places. So they're not just, the geography means something. They're not just places that I've never seen. But yeah, for me, there is a transition. Like, when I close that door behind me, I'm there, even if I'm not, at least mentally I'm there. And then when you walk out, you kind of leave a little bit of it behind you.
Yeah. Wow. Well, Joe, thank you very much. I think that's probably a good note to end on. I really appreciate you making time. I think this is going to be a fantastic addition to kind of, the Spears, our effort to explore the combat experience. And as we started, we realized just how broad that is and how many varying experiences there are. And so I'm really thrilled that we got to have you on and share your story. So thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm really happy to get to do it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Spear. The Spear is produced by the Modern War Institute at West Point. What you hear in each episode are the views of the participants and don't represent the position of West Point, the Army, or the U.S. government. Be sure you're subscribed to The Spear on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app, where you can also give the podcast a rating or leave a review, which helps us reach new listeners. And if you aren't yet following MWI on social media, please find us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Thanks again for listening.